Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American forces deep in Iraq are fighting tonight to round up, root out, and destroy the Iraqi militia of rebel Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. It is a high-wire, high-stakes mission. The fighting is centered in the holy city of Najaf, around one of the holiest shrines in Shia Islam, the Imam Ali Mosque. Checking the militia could clear the way for elections and order. But a false move on sacred ground could also throw Iraq into uncontrollable turmoil. The violence in Najaf brought thousands of Iraqis into the streets of Basra today to protest interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi and the U.S. presence in Iraq. And even a victory in Najaf could backfire. Shiite Iraq and the Shiite world are watching. Tonight on Point, the siege of Najaf and the stakes for the United States and Iraq. I spoke earlier with Alex Berenson, a reporter for the New York Times, who's been with U.S. forces fighting around the city and in its vast cemetery. I asked him to describe the situation as night fell in Najaf.
There's operations happening here on several different fronts. The larger strategic question of what they're going to lead to, I think, is unsettled, but there's no question there's been some military activity today. And the fighting continues in the cemetery, although at a lower pace than it was earlier in this week. But there's still American soldiers in there. There's an army battalion that's operating in there, and they're sort of pushing down, trying to put a little bit of pressure on the rebels from the north, but not too much. From the east and the south of Najaf's old city, another American army unit is sweeping up. I think they're essentially trying to make contact with the soldiers operating to the north so that there's a loose but effective cordon around the old city. Now, you shouldn't think of this as a very tight cordon. It's probably a mile square inside that area. It's not as if there are troops standing around the shrine or anything like that. They're really not very close. And in the cemetery, at least where I was today, there are pretty strict rules on what kind of weapons they can use as they get closer to the shrine. They're being instructed not to push too hard.
This, of course, the Imam Ali Shrine, sacred to Shiites. Has it been damaged? Has there been fighting in or immediately around the shrine today?
No, absolutely not. It has not been damaged. There has been no fighting anywhere near it. American forces are going out of their way not to damage it. The concern is, one, that it could be accidentally damaged in the fighting, and two, that Mr. Sadr, if he does feel trapped and feels that he has no way out, might decide to damage the shrine intentionally as sort of a last stand. And that is the key strategic question that's going, it's going to make it very difficult for American forces to approach the shrine. The other thing that's happening today is that the Marines, who are also here, are going on raids to several semi-strategic places in the city. It's not as if there's fighting throughout the city. I don't want to give that impression. It's sort of like they'll drive up with 100 soldiers. You know, they attacked Mr. Sadr's house, but they knew that he was not at his house. He hasn't been at his house for a long time. And they're moving on other targets. But those targets are not in Najaf's old city, which is sort of the strategically important place. What they're trying to do is poke at Sadr's forces in other parts of the city while the army sets up a cordon around the old city.
So we have American troops, we have the Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi Army militia, and we have some Iraqi regulars and police. What's the goal of each?
Well, the Iraqi forces really are not participating very much in this fighting at all. There's a small number of combat-ready Iraqi troops, but their own commanders will admit privately, and the American commanders will admit privately, they are really not ready to fight. The Marines hope to transform them into a fighting force that's effective, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. For the Americans, the goal is to destroy the Mahdi Army, to destroy Mr. Sadr's rebels. They say they don't want to capture or kill him. I'm sure if that happened, there would be no tears shed at this Marine base. And for Mr. Sadr's troops, he's got two objectives here. One is to hold out as long as possible so that political pressure can build, so that people who don't like the idea of Americans fighting in the streets of Najaf will protest. And the second is he wants to inflict casualties. If he can kill enough American troops, it will be bad news in the United States. They're fighting hard. The soldiers here will acknowledge that they are surprised by how ferociously the Mahdi Army is fighting. And I'll tell you, as somebody who was in a small but close mortar attack today, they're fighting back. And the trump card that Mr. Sadr has is his control of the mosque, because the United States cannot simply go in and roll up to the gates of the mosque. It's not going to happen that way. That much is clear.
How are Iraqis in Najaf responding to this fighting? We've heard many have just left the city. How do you read the population there?
Well, people in Najaf say two things. One is that the city is pretty quiet right now. There's a lot of tension over the fighting, even though it's not as if there are tanks rolling through the streets taking pot shots at houses. But nonetheless, people are staying inside and are nervous. Some people have fled. The second thing is that Najaf is not a Sadr town. This town prospered last year after Saddam was toppled because there were a lot more Shia pilgrims who came here. Religious tourism is probably the biggest industry in Najaf, people coming to the shrine. And that has now dried up because of Mr. Sadr. And there's a lot of people in this town who think that Sadr should just go away. It's not everyone. Sadr obviously has partisans here, too. But there's a lot of people who are followers of Ayatollah Sistani and who think that Sadr is an upstart and who think that Sadr is causing trouble and Sadr has hurt their economy and that his followers are thugs and wish he would disappear.
Of course, Sadr has a bigger audience than just Najaf. And where is Muqtada al-Sadr today as all this fighting goes on? Is it known?
He seems to have been holding press conferences in the shrine. I don't think anyone knows exactly where he is, but it would certainly be in his best interest to stay as close to that shrine as possible. That's his trump card.
And how do the U.S. troops look, Alex? Have they been in close fighting, hand-to-hand in the cemetery?
It's not hand-to-hand. That hasn't happened probably since Korea or maybe Vietnam, but it's close quarters. You can, in many cases, see the men you're fighting with. What happens generally is, first, there are mortars fired from a distance, and those are usually fired from very close to the shrine, which makes it hard for U.S. troops to respond. Normally, they would just call in air power and attack the positions, but that's somewhat difficult to do, although in some cases it does happen. And then the other thing that happens is that very small groups of men, you know, 3 to 5 men, will come up and they'll attack American positions and try to retreat. And they usually attack with rocket-propelled grenades and small arms. And that's a pretty gutsy thing to do, as these troops will tell you. To go up against an armored vehicle with 3 guys and RPGs, you know that there's a pretty high chance you're not coming back from that.
Alex, a final question. Americans saw U.S. Marines pull out of Fallujah this spring after intense fighting there. They just simply pulled back. Is that a likely scenario here? Might that happen here in Najaf? Where is this likely to end?
That's a very good question. I don't necessarily think that pulling out is going to happen because, again, in Fallujah, they were fighting the whole city, and that's a different story. Here, they're not fighting the whole city, and if they didn't have the shrine to deal with, they would probably be able to take out the Mahdi army fairly easily. I don't want to make it sound too easy. This is combat and things happen, but they should be able to do it. It seems possible that there'll be another truce, and in 2 months we'll be doing this again. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's a political question here as much as a military one. I think in Fallujah it was more of a pure military issue of how much force is going to be required to pacify the town.
Alex Berenson, thank you for joining us. Be safe.
Thanks.
Alex Berenson is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Najaf. We are talking tonight about the siege of Najaf and the stakes for the United States and for Iraq. Is the United States drawing a line that can be held in Najaf? Does the U.S. win if it wins in Najaf, or does it just make martyrs? Does victory here seem like a step toward getting out of Iraq, or just another battle in a never-ending series of battles? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Owen Cote. He is the Associate Director of the Securities Studies Program at the University of Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Excuse me. Owen Cote, what is going on here? Why this battle now?
I think the main reason is that the U.S. military's hand has kind of been forced because of the fact that the instability in these southern regions is holding up the political process. And the Shiites are central to that, to the most important group, I think, for the future.
It's holding up what process exactly?
The political process that's leading towards the elections in January. You know, there was this meeting that was going to be held last week that was postponed, and now it's going to be scheduled for this weekend. They've got to get the ball rolling on establishing a legitimate government, and this was holding that up.
And here we are in August. January is no longer that far away.
No, it's just around the corner, really, in terms of the speed at which these things happen. And I think that the military strategy is going to have to be, I think it's going to be, that if these militias want to fight, they'll get one. I don't think
they have one right now.
They have one right now. I don't think that there's a plan in place to go in and root them out house by house, regardless of the consequences, if they can avoid that. So I think what this is actually is that the Sadr and the groups that support him, which are not by any means a majority of the Shiite community, are getting a little desperate because the path that they're on is not good for them in the future, in the long run.
Because they're not lined up to participate in the democracy that the U.S. hopes will unfold there?
I think they could if they wanted to, but I perceive that what's going on is that Sadr understands that in the larger Shiite community, amongst the larger leadership, he's not going to have the status that he probably perceives he would like to have.
So are we looking at Muqtada al-Sadr's last stand here in Najaf?
I don't know that it's going to be his last stand, because I agree with you know, your prior commentator. This will probably keep happening episodically over the next few months. And I think the main goal for the military is going to have to be to try to contain it.
But the interim government in Baghdad needs those elections in January to try to come up with some credibility, more than simply having been essentially named by the United States.
It's absolutely central to the process that those elections go forward and that they be perceived as legitimate by not only the Iraqi people, but also by the international community.
And how big an obstacle to preparation for that has Muqtada al-Sadr and his militia been, and how?
He's an obstacle in the cities where he has supporters, because he's able to prevent order from being established. And if you don't have order, it's very hard to get people to register. It's very hard to get people to participate in the process. And so he's been an obstacle in that sense. But up to this point, I think he's been limited. And I think that the Shiite leadership, the Ayatollah Sistani and others like him, believe that he can eventually, that they can just kind of just hold on and contain this process, and it won't get worse. I think that that's what their belief is, and I haven't seen anything to indicate that they're wrong.
They may think that way, but right now there's a huge operation going on in Najaf, which is not rope-a-dope here. This is engaging completely with his militia in that city. Did Muqtada al-Sadr want this fight?
There's a lot of discussions going on about what happened here. There's some discussions about how he was promised something that would maybe have caused him to tell his militia to hold back, and then he was perceived that was taken away from him. I'm not an expert on those kinds of conversations, but I think Sadr's probably trying to negotiate the maximum voice for what he perceives to be his movement. It's not a large movement as things stand now within the larger Shia community.
But it's made for a lot of turmoil. The U.S. and the Baghdad government want it out of the way in time to prepare for elections. But they are sitting on a fuse to a huge powder keg here. What are the risks if this goes wrong? How high is the danger that it goes wrong? And even if they win, do they win?
There's huge risks here, and I think you see that they are acknowledging that. There's this incredible symbolism of the mosque in Najaf. It's the equivalent of Mecca and Medina for the Shia community. So that's a tremendous—
As sacred as it gets for the Shia community.
Also, there's the general question in these kinds of situations, which is if the military responds to this challenge— or the series of challenges that I think we're going to face, goes too far and is perceived as being indiscriminate. You have the danger that you're going to actually create more supporters for Sadr than you're killing.
Even as you're going about the business of doing that.
Even as you're doing that.
And that's the win but lose scenario, that they say, we've cordoned off the shrine, we've cordoned off the cemetery, we've disbanded. And then in Sadr City, Sadr's kind of a big support suburb of Baghdad, boom.
That's the core of his support in Sadr City. In Najaf, I think, as we were hearing before, there's the possibility that this will work because he's not popular there. That's not the base of his support.
But his father organized the poor, spoke to the poor, and so does he.
And so does he.
Presumably they are all watching right now.
Yes, they are. And you're right to point out that there's a little bit of a, whether you call it a class thing or whatever, here within the Shia community. And Sadr definitely does represent, in some sense, the voice of those who feel dispossessed in that community.
And the Shia, of course, have been dispossessed for a long time. If they should go up in flames, well, lots of ramifications. Owen Cote, stand by. We'll have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the siege of Najaf and the stakes for the United States and Iraq. You can join the conversation. Does the U.S. win if it wins in Najaf? Or does it just make martyrs and bring on more opposition? How do you interpret the fierce fighting in that huge, dusty cemetery underneath that shrine's golden dome? Is the United States drawing a line that can be held in Najaf? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the siege of Najaf. It is underway right now. We're looking at that siege, the U.S. effort there, and the high-wire American effort to defuse a Muqtada al-Sadr martyrdom there. You can join the conversation tonight. Does victory in Najaf seem like a step toward getting out of Iraq, or just another in a never-ending series of battles? Do you feel things moving toward order in Iraq or slipping toward chaos? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Scott Baldoff is the Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me today from Baghdad. I asked him how the drama in Najaf is playing more broadly in Iraq and who's rooting for whom as U.S. troops and Sadr's militia face off.
There's a little bit of more sentiment coming to Muqtada al-Sadr's militia as the holy shrine of Ali is surrounded now by U.S. troops, so U.S. tanks and Iraqi troops. Even though Iraqi troops are likely to be the ones who make any final push into the shrine itself, if it comes to that, still the public sentiment is very strongly growing against any assault on the shrine that could hurt the shrine. And people that we've been talking to say that they would blame the U.S. government and also the Iraqi government if any damage were to occur to the shrine.
What can be won and what can be lost in the way this fight in Najaf is resolved?
Well, the politics of this are very peculiar because of the very strong sentiment that we see among Shias in favor of martyrdom. There's a tradition of martyrdom that goes way back to the very founders of the Shia sect of Islam. Many of the Shiite faith founders had been martyrs themselves, and that is something that strikes very strong chords among Shias. So the problem is this. If Muqtada al-Sadr is killed or defeated in some way, he becomes a martyr. That draws more and more support to him because he is seen as the underdog from the outset. If he manages to negotiate a settlement in which he still has a place at the table, then he wins again by having stared down the United States and the new Iraqi government and gotten himself a place at the table through violence. It's very hard to see what the Iraqi government can do other than what it's currently doing, which is to simply try to squash him as much as they can with as much force as possible without damaging the shrine.
But U.S. military officials are quite clear that they don't want to make him a martyr. They say they do want to crush, essentially, his militia, the Mahdi Army. Can that be done if they, let's say they overwhelm the Mahdi Army in Najaf? Is that the end of it?
It probably will not be the end of it. There will likely be backlashes in other cities. Already we're seeing fighting on an almost daily basis in a Baghdad suburb of Sadr City, which is a Shiite majority-held area with perhaps 2.5 million residents. This is an area of very strong support for Muqtada al-Sadr. There are other cities in the south which are also fighting against the Iraqi troops, most notably in Kut, which is south of Baghdad. That's an area where there have been some 70 deaths just in the last day and another 100 injured. Now, these numbers all point in the wrong direction as far as the Americans are concerned. We're going to see more and more support, more and more fighting, even if they win a battle in Najaf.
So you don't think that the U.S. forces and Iraqi forces there, with a successful operation in Najaf, could send a message that order is winning here and militias are yesterday's cause, their history?
Well, if they're going to do it, it's going to have to take more than one city. They really have no other choice than to continue what they are doing, politically speaking. But again, the Shiites that we speak to, and many of these are not friends of Muqtada al-Sadr, say that the sentiment right now among Shias is that they have been held out of power for all of the reign of Saddam Hussein, and for many years even before that, Shias have seen themselves as the oppressed majority of Iraq. They make up 60% 10% of the population, but usually they are left out of the power-sharing agreements. And even though the current prime minister himself, Ayad Alawi, is a Shia, he was handpicked by the U.S. This is not, as far as they're concerned, a government of their choosing, and they want a better play at the table.
No easy answer here. Scott Baldoff, thanks for joining us from Baghdad.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Scott Baldoff is Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Baghdad. We're talking tonight about the siege of Najaf and its implications. I've been joined in the studio by Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. I'm joined now from South Dartmouth, Massachusetts, by Andrew Hess. He is Director of the Southwest Asia and Islamic Civilization Program at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's a former captain in the U.S. Marines. Andrew Hess, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And we are joined from Alexandria, Virginia, by Patrick Lang, a retired U.S. Army colonel, former Special Forces officer, former Chief of Intelligence for the Middle East, South Asia, and Counterterrorism at the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's author of Intelligence, the Human Factor. He heads up the Global Resources Group now. It's a consultancy to businesses in the Middle East. Patrick Lang, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
So we're looking at what's going on in Najaf and if and whether the United States and the Baghdad government can come out winners. Andrew Hess, let me turn first to you. Can a win-win situation be made out of this?
I don't think so. I think that this region of the world that we're dealing with, Southwest Asia or Iraq and so on, is terribly unstable. And in it and outside of it, we have a Islamic resurgency affair going on. And we're in the age of information. And so this information revolution. And so all of this fighting and dying and bloodshed and so on is spreading throughout the Muslim world, and if it continues to be the case, then it's going to make the situation even worse than what's revealed in the Pew.com surveys about the attitudes of most Muslims towards the American government.
So you're looking very broadly. Forgive me, I don't mean this. It sounds defeatist. If the Baghdad government, if Washington wants to push toward elections and a more credible central government, what alternative do they have to trying to secure order in places like Najaf, where they're challenged by a militia?
Well, they do indeed have to make sure that there's some security in Iraq, or no politics is going to take place. We'll just have increasing disorder. But to do anything that touches upon the symbols that overrides the boundaries of Iraq is just going to encourage a greater problem. And the greater problem is probably going to come with Iran in terms of the region.
Meaning
that the resistance of Muqtada al-Sadr against the Iraqi government is undermining the policy of the Iranians that they had adopted just at the outset of all of this violence in Iraq, which is not to like the presence of the United States next door to them, but rather to hope that somehow the United States could put in place a government that would be stable and wouldn't be a threat to Iran, and Iran could continue all of the ties it's had in the past with a stable Shi'i community in Iraq.
So here we are in this incredibly complex situation with huge Shiite Iran just across the border looking on. Of course, the shrine in Najaf is a shrine to all Iranian Shia as well. And the question is, can the United States, can the central government come out here a winner? Patrick Lang, Andrew Hess is very skeptical about whether, even with a short-term win, the U.S. can come out a winner here. How do you see it?
Well, you know, the way you understand this situation depends on what sort of paradigm you look at it through, and I don't think it's particularly useful to view this, what's going on in Najaf, and even what went on in Fallujah, as a contest between the United States military and the insurgents, whether they're Sunni or Shia. In fact, what you're looking at is a process of politics in a country which has experienced a revolutionary change. I mean, we removed the previous government, smashed it all to bits. And in the great tradition of Mesopotamian politics over the last 1,300 years, whenever there's a change of regime, all the different factions, groups, and individuals that want to be something or somebody all start competing with each other until the thing settles out and it's decided who's going to have what. And as one of your earlier speakers said, Muqtada al-Sadr was led to believe after he was defeated at Najaf earlier this year that if he came into the mix, that there would be something for him in the future of Iraq. In the last two or three weeks, it appeared to him, from what I'm told from Baghdad, that in fact that was not going to happen. So I think that's probably what triggered his trip back to the streets. But the problem with Iraqi Shia in a situation like this, involving Najaf especially, is that they become uncontrollable very quickly. And I think he's had to sign up to the most extreme kind of positions in order to try to maintain leadership. And now everybody's sort of locked into a bad position.
Let me ask you, though. You say this is not a conflict essentially between the United States and Shia militia, but tell that to the Marines and Army regulars who are there fighting in that cemetery tonight, taking a lot of fire all around Najaf.
Yeah, well,
I realize it's a political... But the point is, if there's a political shakeout going on here, it sounds very logical, as you say, then does it help for the United States to be in the middle of it, or is it a shakeout that's going to have to follow its own way? Maybe it'd be better off not to have the U.S. military bringing that factor into play.
Look, from the tactical point of view, everything is always the same thing. If you're in a squad-sized ambush or you're in the Battle of Gettysburg, the two things are equally lethal and important to you. But if you're looking at it from the strategic point of view, in fact, the issue here is whether or not the Alawi government can stabilize itself by forming a national consensus that will isolate its opponents and enable it to destroy them. And in this kind of a situation, the revolt of the Mahdi militia in Najaf is something which cannot be accepted, because defiance of the interim government is something that will destroy it and will cause us to have a very, very difficult time in Iraq.
But one wonders if the tool of U.S. forces being used to address it,
well,
and granted,
else.
What are you supposed to do? Because the Central Army there isn't going to work, but is the tool itself a kind of provocation?
Well, sometimes, you know, in the world of war and international politics, it's often a choice between unpleasant and undesirable alternatives.
No kidding.
And that is the case here, and because... if not U.S. forces to destroy and make ineffective the Mahdi army, then there is no one else. Because I am not convinced at all that the resurgent Iraqi security forces are capable of dealing with this situation, even if it gets down to how you're going to deal with the Imam Ali Mosque itself. So there's nothing else to do. You have to do what you have to do.
There's no evidence they can pick it up. These are not easy choices. And yet we can hear the clear disagreement about potential outcomes, even at the strategic level here. Patrick Lang, Andrew Hess, Owen Cote, stand by for a moment. I want to begin to invite our callers in. Steve is calling from Kingston, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. The observation I wanted to make is to enter into the conversation what I, as a junior officer in the Army many years ago, learned is a maxim of warfare, and that is victory is defined, or victory arrives, when you defeat the enemy's willingness to continue resisting.
Okay.
I think this was the fundamental failure of the strategy of a fast capture of territory in Iraq, is we forgot about the fact that the war wouldn't end until we'd really beaten back the ability and willingness of the enemy to resist. Therefore, what's happening in Najaf, we may succeed there, but I can't help the feeling that we're going to have to do that over and over again in Fallujah and countless other towns until the enemy's willingness to resist is done.
Steve, we've got it, and we appreciate that insight from your early training days. Owen Cote, what about it? Victory as overwhelming the will to resist. By that standard, are we making progress here?
Well, excuse me. Steve's absolutely right. That's the basic condition that has to occur for you to have some sort of victory. What I would say is that Fallujah and Najaf are different. Najaf is in the heart of the Shia community. The Shia community and most of the respected leadership in the Shia community is one of the main group, as we said, 60% of the population. They're up till now been working with us and with this interim government, and also retained the support of many of their followers.
Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani,
right.
Now conveniently in London, but that's been essentially his posture.
Right. So this is a group that is absolutely central to keep on our side and to support. And so I see what's going on in Najaf right now as an attempt, admittedly dangerous, to try and shore up what has been a success story when there haven't been many.
That the Shia have been generally on board.
Generally supportive. Najaf, Fallujah is fundamentally different. There is no future for Iraq where the Sunni are going to come out better than they were under Saddam in terms of
status.
They're
the minority. They stepped on the necks of the Kurds and the Shia.
So,
they're not going to accept that again.
We are not going to defeat their willingness to fight by engaging with them. Their options don't lie. And there are no options that lie with cooperation with us for most of the people in that community. So I think there's two. We're not going to have to do this everywhere, but I do think when it pops, when things like this happen, when Sadr's groups do this in the South, I think that we have to respond. We just absolutely have to, because if we don't, there won't be a political process that leads to the end game.
Andrew Hess, large-scale risks here, but what is the alternative, as we're hearing here, to getting in there and trying to pull out of the mix Sadr's people who just don't want to play the game that the other Shias seem to be ready to play?
Well, I think that we should apply some diplomacy, really, and what we are doing that, in effect, right now by withdrawing and letting the Iraqis try to talk the al-Sadr out of movement away from the mosque area, the Imam Ali Mosque. And then there are other issues that we can take up which would probably be helpful. One of those would be to have serious discussions with the Iranians so that we make sure that those people who are supporting Iranian objectives in Iraq don't add to the weight that we are already carrying in terms of al-Sadr. And then we also have to deal with the other Shi'i groups, the Dawa and so on, that have already started to shift over in the direction of al-Sadr.
But if you say it's a bad idea to be fighting this fight in Najaf, and it's clearly high risk, if the U.S. troops weren't doing it and the Iraqi troops can't do it, doesn't that just put a roadblock across the path to elections and more greater stability?
That's certainly one option that can be played, yeah, certainly.
So that means that would
isolating him.
But that seem to be suggesting there's no alternative to this fight.
Well, I don't know whether there is an alternative or not, because I'm not on the ground over there, and I suppose that anything can happen when you get a large number of forces with heavy equipment in a fight in an area as small as Najaf. Anyway, if one of the outcomes is to make al-Sadr a martyr, then we have a huge problem that goes beyond the boundaries of Iraq. On the other hand, if they sit there for a while and nothing happens, and then some of the Shi'i leaders begin to have second thoughts about what would happen if the whole situation became very much paralyzed by al-Sadr, and he seized leadership of the Shi'i movement in Iraq and got support from the outside. So there's plenty to be done on the ground, but it should be a mixture of politics and the use of military force when appropriate.
Patrick Lang, just half a minute before the break here, but through this fog and smoke of war, do you see things in Iraq on a path toward greater stability or not as we sit here this evening?
Well, you know, I'm not as pessimistic as some of these other folks are. I think there are two things going on here. Under the surface, as is usual in the Middle East, there is a political process in play in which the Alawi government tries to establish itself. On the surface, you have all this violence, which is endemic in Iraqi politics through the ages. And you have this use of force by the United States to try to enforce the interim government's will. You know, I think it's undecided how this is going to turn out. And I think it's a big mistake to see this as anything other than a political process. If you start thinking about this as about good guys and bad guys, you're going to find very few good guys over there.
But the crux of it, we don't know how it's going to turn out. We're talking about the siege of Najaf tonight. Patrick Lang, Andrew Hess, Owen Cote, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Why is it still American soldiers doing the real fighting against insurgents and not Iraqis, even now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the siege of Najaf, underway as we speak, and the stakes there for the United States and Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. Does the United States win? If it wins in Najaf, does Muqtada al-Sadr come out a winner, no matter what happens, as a dead martyr, as a live rebel? The bigger question, is the U.S. turning a corner in Iraq with Najaf or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Owen Cote, Associate Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. With me in the studio, from Alexandria, Virginia, by Patrick Lang, a retired U.S. Army colonel, former Special Forces officer, former Chief of Intelligence for the Middle East, South Asia, and Counterterrorism at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and from South Dartmouth, Massachusetts, by Andrew Hess, Director of the Southwest Asia and Islamic Civilization Program at the Fletcher Officer School at Tufts University, a former captain in the U.S. Marines. Reza is calling right now from Boston. Hi, Reza. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, what's on your mind, Reza?
Yes, I just wanted to say that, first of all, Al-Sadr and Al-Sadr's family, the fanatics, and to compromise with them or to go and talk with them, they don't understand peace, and they only understand force, and it has to be answered by force.
You say they're fanatics, but they're very popular fanatics, if indeed they are fanatics. His father, a huge figure, symbol of hope and unity to poor Shia, killed by Saddam Hussein. Is that a fanatical position to hold?
Well, his father, his grandfather, his uncle, they were all, and Khomeini, they were all at the same rank. And his father and his uncle, they wanted to be the Grand Ayatollah. And there was a fight between the Ayatollahs in Iran and Iraq. None of them support each other.
So it sounds like you didn't like Iran's Khomeini and you don't like these Iraqi Shia either. But a lot of Iraqis clearly do. Why?
Well, majority of Iraqis are Shias and majority of them are against al-Sadr. They're only...
Fair enough.
Hello?
So, fair enough. So you're saying the only way is the hardline way.
Yeah, that's the only way he understands.
Reza, thanks very much for your call. Owen Cote, how about it? There's even been talk that the, I don't want to sort of, slander a whole family here, but martyrdom, the theme of martyrdom runs deep in Shia Islam, and the al-Sadr family has even been described as having a kind of urge to martyrdom. Muqtada's father died at Saddam's hand and became
right.
a martyr.
Right. I mean, I think the argument that you can only use the hard line with this group is right as far as it goes. The problem is that the symbolic aspect of the operations we're talking about tonight, which is you really could win the battle and lose something much greater if you, in some sense, damage or destroy this symbol that has such great power for all Shia. So that's the thing that's a danger. But I don't disagree with the proposition that you in isolation, all other things being equal, it is kind of you do deal with this group with a hard line. And I think that there's tacit support for that amongst the other Shia leadership.
Let's get another call. Ed is calling from Chicago. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I don't remember. I don't know if you remember me calling when we were talking about the Iraqi constitution.
I do not, but I'm glad to have you, Ed. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, I'm a little bit concerned because I love the program, but I keep hearing people that seem to know what they're talking about and they're highly educated. But from where I'm sitting, it looks like there's going to be a huge Shia revolution, and that whether we stay there or not is of little consequence. And what Baghdad's going to turn into is one giant Beirut airport. And I want us to get our men and women out of there now before more of them die. And I don't care about your guest's thesis or, I'm really getting upset about this. Nobody is telling the truth.
And the truth as you see it is a kind of a general Shia uprising. The United States can't stop it.
Yeah, tell me, how many guests have you had on your show over the last 2 months that have been optimistic and have, it's like the happy talk on Fox News about how life is better in Iraq and all that. When I go to independent news sources, we're hunkered down in there trying not to take losses, and every time we stick our head up, we get it blown off. I mean, we need to pull our men and women out of there now.
Ed, I think I've got to wonder about your listening. I mean, we've heard quite a spectrum here, and just last week heard a pretty dismal report from a whole panel of correspondents there, but we're not opposed to looking for light if there is some, but we take your point and let us dig right into it. Andrew Hess, this seems to be speaking to your concern.
Yes, and I think that a lot of what he has to say makes sense because the social and cultural situation of the Shi'i community in Iraq is not very modern in our terms, and they respond therefore to those forces which touch upon the symbols of those institutions that they hold sacred, and one of those institutions is the sense of being pushed down by others, and the resistance to that often takes the form of being a martyr. And the Shi'i have every year a passion play in which they celebrate the death of Hussein, mm-hmm. The son of Ali,
right.
and Ali's death, and so on. So their entire culture is preparing them for some sort of a situation like they're going through now. And what the use of force by outsiders who are not even Sunnis but non-Muslims makes them fall back on that, where normally they would be divided up into groups that would be local or village or client patronage related or one a division after another.
But what about our caller Ed's prescription then? He says, let's just get American troops out of there and let evolution take its course. What do you say to that, Andrew Hess?
Well, it touches upon the policy for this area of the world right now. Are we going to go about changing the culture of the region by force, or are we going to somehow accommodate the situation on the ground as it exists over there and deal with the issues that produce violence locally and division? So we should be probably talking about economic development and other issues rather than who's using the most machine guns to shoot at the other guy.
Patrick Lang, let me put that broad question, same question to you. Yes, the U.S. forces are there, and you're saying given that we're engaged in this, this is the right thing to do, but what about the broader issue? Should they be there? Do they need to be there?
Well, you know, the die is cast, isn't it? I mean, that question was answered when the 3rd Mechanized Division crossed the border into Iraq a year and a half ago or whatever it was. We now have this problem to deal with, which is a real-world problem, not an academic problem.
But let's treat the notion of a withdrawal as a real-world option.
Well, what happens then is that in fact, the Shia civil war that one of your callers described probably breaks out with great ferocity, and that you end up with a rump state of Iraq in the south, which is within the Iranian orbit. Is that what we really want? I don't think so in terms of the geopolitics of the region. And at the same time, the Kurds go their own way in some way or another, which is probably going to be very destabilizing, especially when you consider what the Turks think about that. So, you know, we're there. We're stuck with this, so we have to deal with it as best we can. These are real-world problems. This isn't just a lot of stuff that you publish in some academic journal.
Do you see, on the other hand, a path toward a real unified Iraq emerging?
Well, you know, the process of Middle Eastern politics is always the same everywhere. These are real politics. What you're talking about are people forming alliances, intimidating their opponents, bringing people into their side in some kind of consensus, making deals under the table. That's what Middle Eastern politics are about. And Iraq in this situation is no different. If the Alawi government cannot form a sufficiently stable government to go forward in the election, and I'm sure he hopes to be elected, then in fact you're going to have a disintegration of the situation in which American forces are going to be stuck in that country in a chaotic situation. Is that what we want? I don't think so. So I think we ought to stop slamming Alawi.
Owen Cote, final thought. Is there an option to the path we're on?
Well, I think that if the Alawi government and if Ambassador Negroponte, if the U.S. leadership thought that trying to deal with Sadr in the way that they're trying to deal with them was going to lead to a general Shia revolution, I can guarantee you they wouldn't be doing this. I think they believe that they're doing the opposite, which is that they are protecting, as we discussed before, a majority community that so far has been with them. Now, whether they're going to succeed or not, I don't know. It's far from guaranteed that this is going to work out, and I don't mean to give the impression, if I did, that I am confident or guaranteeing that it will. But I think that that's what the intent is.
And the stakes are high, and we've seen that vista tonight. Owen Cote, thank you so much for joining us. Patrick Lang in Alexandria, Virginia, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure.
And Andrew Hess, thanks so much for joining us this evening. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a Londoner reacts to the British government's new terrorism safety pamphlet. This is On Point. Last week's orange alert once again left Americans wondering just what they're supposed to do to protect themselves. Across the pond this week, the British government is mailing out 25 million copies of an official leaflet with advice on what to do in case of a terrorist attack. The booklet is being sent to every household in Britain. Londoner Keith Parker received his terror advice pamphlet on Monday and did a careful read through the literature. In this radio diary, Keith Parker says he doubts how the little booklet could help anyone prepare for the unthinkable.
So, it finally arrived in my mailbox, the new safety booklet issued by Her Majesty's Government, entitled Preparing for Emergencies, What You Need to Know. Now, this is the third time in my life that I've been issued a brochure that helps me prepare for cataclysm, and frankly, I consider that to be three too many. First, in 1955, Her Majesty's government issued a brochure entitled Advising the Householder on Protection Against Nuclear Attack. In it, sensible hints such as stockpiling canned food sufficient for 14 days, whitewashing windows to lessen the heat of a nuclear blast, and keeping a change of footwear handy to avoid trailing fallout dust into our bunkers beneath the stairs. Piece of cake, really. No worse than a spot of bad weather. Although, secretly, should the Soviets have struck, 12 million Britons were expected to die. Advisory pamphlet number 2 materialized in 1980. This, in a burst of Thatcherite verbal economy, was simply called Protect and Survive. A gloomier document, full of bleak line drawings that showed us how to build fallout shelters by leaning bedroom doors at a 45-degree angle against the wall, how to make improvised toilets out of chairs, and how to tag corpses of dead relatives when burying them in the garden in the middle of nuclear winter. Still, I made it to adulthood, despite the odds, and the prospect of a future free from Armageddon felt good. But now I realize with horror, here we are again. New threat. New pamphlet. Tony Blair's Preparing for Emergencies has arrived. I quote, "This booklet will tell you how you can help yourself and your family in emergencies. A lot of this information is based on common sense advice and may seem obvious or familiar to you, but it has saved lives in the past." Not an auspicious start. It doesn't even define what an emergency is until page 6. It's all about terrorism, of course, but I search in vain for a mention of Al-Qaeda anywhere in its 22 glossy pages. It does mention bombs, fire, and CBR, chemical, biological, or radiological incident. And we're encouraged to be vigilant and look out for suspicious behavior, vehicles, or packages. Londoners might well blink at this, considering that this is what we've been doing ever since 1969, when things started to get somewhat out of hand in Northern Ireland. Still, at least now I know what to do if ever I should find myself trapped in debris following a bomb blast. Stay close to a wall and tap on pipes so that the rescuers can hear me. Serious stuff, and I take it as so, because I have been told by the British government that I must. On the back page of Preparing for Emergencies is a small footnote stating that the Blair government encourages us to make copies of the pamphlet, but, and I quote again, "this is subject to the material not being used in a derogatory manner." Derogatory manner? But aren't we British known for our humour? Perhaps. But our government most certainly is not. Last Sunday, Home Secretary David Blunkett warned that American-style openness over the Al-Qaeda threat risked exposing politicians to ridicule. He dismissed calls for him to supply more details to the British public as arrant nonsense. So, you in America are informed with your orange alerts, and we in the UK are prepared with our pamphlets. How's that for a special relationship? I've heard Americans worry that if terrorists attacked their hometowns, they wouldn't know what to do. Really? Tony Blair's got a pamphlet for you on how to spot terrorists in the shrubbery. I, for one, would much rather have the truth.
Keith Parker lives in London. You can take a look at the UK's Preparing for Emergencies pamphlet on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.